Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, continuing our conversations about the culture of consciousness. And conversations is the word, because it seems to me that one of the challenges we all face these days is to try to integrate multiple perspectives, points of view, parts of ourselves, our bodies, our social roles. And it's an incredibly complicated world, as you all know. And the dance of integration is a very tricky one. And one of the great models, I think, for this dance is conversation, social relations, small groups of people conversing. Becomes a way to both speak a point of view and weave that point of view into a larger network or conversation. One of the great analogies for me in my life for this process has actually been drumming, like being in a drum circle. I'm not a great drummer, but I don't suck. And with a drum circle, it's really interesting because you ideally have, everyone has their own rhythm, their own beat. They're putting their own thing out there. And some people aren't saying that much. They're just kind of holding the line. And then you have these great talkers who can weave these stories partly out of their own brilliance, their own expression, their own spontaneity and improvisation, but partly by listening and weaving together different things that different people are saying. So it's this wonderful model of being in society, of being in a world with multiple perspectives, of acknowledging those perspectives, not collapsing them into one point of view, but also refusing to just sort of listen to your own, the beat of your own drum. And I say this as preface to our guest today, Professor Michael Zimmerman. And I first read Michael's work in 1994 when he came out with a book called Contesting Earth's Future, which, though that was 20 years ago now, is still a very relevant book, partly because the various perspectives and points of view that Michael brings into question there, or brings into conversation, I should say, are still incredibly relevant about different ways of thinking about the Earth, human beings, technology, meaning, the purpose of human life, how do we relate with each other, how do we relate with the Earth. And he has a wonderful skill of really sympathizing, empathizing, understanding where very different kinds of people are coming from in their arguments. Right wing, left wing, individualist, collectivist, materialist, mystical, across the board. Is this great ability to appreciate points of view, which is something that's been very important to me, and it was very inspiring to me in reading his work. And then, you know, critically and intelligently weaving these perspectives, seeing where they interrelate, seeing where they share some points of view, and seeing where they're different and where you have to clarify the important differences. And so while he remains very much a philosophy professor, reasonable, insightful, with deep knowledge, particularly of Heidegger and Nietzsche, who are philosophers that I keep coming back to in my life and I think are incredibly important figures to wrestle with in different ways and for different reasons. But he's also very keen on parts of thought, parts of experience that are a little outside of the normal academic framework. For us here, and particularly of interest is his writings on transhumanism, and this the ideas, whether it's technologically expressed or different ideas of radical human evolution and some of the philosophical implications there, as well as the work of Ken Wilber, is that Michael sees his work in line with the larger integral project in many ways, though not in all ways. And he also co-wrote a book on integral ecology called Integral Ecology, Using Multiple Perspectives on the Natural World. And there again, you see this idea, this quest, this challenge of weaving in multiple perspectives without collapsing them to one point of view, but also without just, you know, losing your way in the cacophony from different points of view. So I'm sure we're going to have an excellent conversation. I finally got to meet Michael about 4 years ago at a transhumanism symposium, and it was really wonderful, and I'm glad he joined us today on the show. But before we bring him on, our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daou. Hey, Maja.
Hi, Eric.
You know, I was just thinking about this, and when I said it out loud, and I know we were just chatting about Nietzsche before, he's still, like, I got to say, is like of all the philosophers I've read and struggled with, and I have read and struggled with many, that he's still kind of the one, even though it's sort of like what you read when you're 15, you're like, hey, you got to check this out. You know, when I run run up to people who haven't really spent time with Friedrich, I'm like, you know, you really got to owe it to yourself. I think you're in this boat as well, right?
I am, although I wouldn't say he's my quintessential go-to. He unmistakably leaves an impression. And the thing I've enjoyed most, I think, with him in particular is the hookups between his philosophy and how he lays it out and how he describes it with these universal themes involved in religion. This process that is involved in almost all the occult material, a lot of the people who created scientific method, who come up with, like, how to think, basically. So whenever I see someone and they're talking about those themes in terms of, like, defeating the animal, rising to the conscience, and, like, doing this whole alchemical process, I mean, I just know they're on to something correct. So he definitely is included in the club.
Yeah, that's actually a really very insightful point, is that even though Nietzsche himself did not write or talk about what we would think of as esotericism very much, and when he did, he would often make fun of it, that he's a very important thinker for people who are interested in certain aspects of religion or spirituality, but are also not interested in other aspects of it. I mean, he spent so much of his life, you know, deconstructing Christian morality, and yet the way he did it was something that was very inspiring to a lot of esotericists. Rudolf Steiner, for example, just absolutely adored Nietzsche,
wrote
a book about Nietzsche, and so it's kind of funny. So there's like this sort of esoteric Nietzsche that's out there as well that does relate to this transhumanist stuff.
Yeah, I think so too.
Great. Well, with that, let's bring Michael onto the show. Michael, thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
It's great to be here, Eric and Maja.
Cool. Well, you know, I'm a little at loose ends because I have this long list of topics that I would love to talk to you about, and I can't really decide. I guess since we started off talking about transhumanism, and I know that you've written some recent articles about that, and they're well worth checking out online. And I know also you've been tracking this for a long time. So I'd love to hear a little bit about what first got you interested in these ideas, maybe how your sense of things, how they are now, how they perhaps changed a little bit, and why they remain philosophically so compelling.
Well, this is a lifelong project, I suppose, so I'm going to have to cut it down a bit in order to make it fit into your show. But I got real interested in issues surrounding technology back in the 60s and 70s, mainly in connection with the consequences of industrial technology for the natural environment. So I found that Heidegger had a lot of interesting things to say about all that, and I wrote some essays in the 70s about Heidegger and deep ecology. In fact, I'm right now finishing up an essay for a journal called The Trumpeter, which is a deep ecology journal celebrating its 30th anniversary. And I was just going really through, it's kind of a retrospective, I'm going through the changes I went through in the last 40 years in regard to my thoughts about not only about environmentalism, but also about modernity, which is responsible for industrial technology. And that, you know, really brings up, in a way, this whole issue of perspectives and Nietzsche, about which you were speaking a moment ago. Maybe we can return to that. But I did a lot of stuff in the philosophy of technology, but in the 90s, I really spent most of my time, and also in the early part of this century, working on environmental issues, environmental philosophy. And then one day, I think it was in 2007 or 6, I forget, it was around Christmas, I was vacationing down in the Florida Panhandle, and I happened to go into a small bookstore on the beach. You know, a philosophy professor cannot resist a small bookstore on the beach. There on the bookshelf was this book, which was practically throbbing with its intensity, and it was Ray Kurzweil's book, The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology, is the subtitle. And so I bought it and read it and was completely blown away, because there was this whole discourse going on for the past 10 or 20 years, which I had not followed very much, about trans and posthumanism. And these themes echoed with me, because there's a theme of posthumanism as well in so-called continental philosophy coming out of Nietzsche and Heidegger and so on. But there are two very different conceptions of posthumanism. And maybe that's something we can talk about.
Yeah, like a really good point to maybe clarify. In one way that I've been thinking about, maybe this actually confuses things a little bit, but I was thinking about this distinction that you pointed out when you look at the question of the transhuman in the sort of technological singularity sense, where there's this sort of overcoming, and a lot of transhumanists will reference Nietzsche. They'll talk about the Übermensch. They'll talk about this idea of the man is just a bridge between the ape and the Superman, and now we have the capacity to make ourselves into Superman, maybe through biological extensions or through downloading ourselves to computers or robots that then can go out and live forever, whatever. We're sort of familiar with these visions, and in a way there's a resonance, but in a way there's something very different that's happening with Nietzsche and the Übermensch, and particularly through this idea of contrasting Nietzsche's vision of the Overman, the Übermensch, and the last man, which people don't think about enough, and I know that you've written about. So I don't know whether that confuses the issue, but I'm going to throw that out there.
All right. Well, it's a good question, a good topic for conversation. You know, Nietzsche, as you were suggesting, is a very attractive and also repellent figure, because he's so brilliant and says fabulous things, but also says awful things, which are difficult to reconcile with my commitment to something like democratic principles. He was not interested in any of that. And nevertheless, he makes important criticisms of, modern democracies. But a lot of, not all trans/posthumanists call on Nietzsche. Kurzweil is more, he doesn't use Nietzsche very much, I think, probably for good reasons. But in Zarathustra, when Nietzsche's in the prologue or the introduction to Thus Spoke Zarathustra, Nietzsche speaks about the human being as walking a tightrope across an abyss. Behind the human is the ape, and what lies ahead is the overman, and that, the human is something that must be overcome, and going under, if the humanity will go under in order to allow the overman to emerge, that's really our highest calling. Now, it's not hard to see how you could put this to good use in terms of techno-posthumanism, because you can say, well, look, Nietzsche, in his own vocabulary, was anticipating what we're saying, that what we're doing with modern technology and artificial intelligence and supercomputing is we're preparing the way for forms of intelligence and forms of really post-human life that is the next step in cosmic evolution, and we ought to get on board with that. I mean, it's the next great thing. Why stand against it? But, you know, Nietzsche was – I don't think Nietzsche would have – been necessarily on board with this program, since he did not. You will not find a lot of reference in that book or any of his books to how technical enhancements can provide a way to get to a new type of humanity or post-humanity.
Well, that's the problem I have with the with the transhumanists appropriating Nietzsche's work in that fashion is because if you look at what he's talking about there, you know, with the Uberman, this is something that is talked about all over the place in other areas in similar ways. They might use different words, right, like superego or conscious or higher self or HGA, as Aleister Crowley calls it, or, you know, there's so many different words for it. So I feel like the transhumanists aren't even understanding what he's talking about. And what he's talking about is something that has been talked about before. It has been accomplished by human beings before and with absolutely no technology. So we're talking about something supposedly, if you believe stories of some of these mystics or religious figures, they have in fact accomplished this feat using no technology whatsoever.
Except the technology associated with spiritual practices, and those are real technologies,
right?
Because
yeah,
they don't involve machinery, it doesn't mean they're not techniques, and that's, I think that's something to keep in mind. I would also say I would contest your claim that what Nietzsche said, a bunch of other people have already said. I think that there's so many different ways of talking about this, and I'm hesitant to say they're really pointing at the same thing. Let's just, so I would like to bracket that part of what you're saying, because I'm not so sure. But
sure.
Nevertheless, I think you're right in suggesting that there have been extraordinary human beings. I think of Jesus and Buddha and a number of others, great historical figures. Even Nietzsche continued to respect Jesus to the end, who achieved extraordinary feats of consciousness evolution, which there's a reason why these figures have retained their influence for thousands of years. They were incredible human beings. And one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about in connection with Nietzsche, you know, Nietzsche is writing at the end of the 19th century, and what comes before him is Marx and Feuerbach and Hegel and Schelling and all these people in German idealism and so on. And I want to put this out for you and your listeners, where Nietzsche might be coming from. You know, back in the, this has to do with Christianity, and I know, Eric, in your book, Technosis, you deal a lot with the underground psychological and spiritual yearnings that are still at work in a supposedly, you know, secular, scientific modern world. And I think there are these elements at work in trans and posthumanism. They are, as Kurzweil in effect says, these are spiritual processes. These yearnings are informed by subterranean influences, which are not always up front, in part because the people involved with them perhaps they lack an understanding of where they're coming from. But let me put it out this way. What does it mean that Jesus Christ became human, that God became man? I mean, this is the big challenge posed by Christianity. And one of the things that one interpretation of this was put forth by Saint Athanasius in the 12th century. He says, and this is a great quote, God became man so that man could become God. Now, you know, that is a powerful saying, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, what Luther gets this. He picks up on this, and he agrees with this. But his idea of man becoming God really is through God's grace, in effect, allowing us in the new life with rebirth to achieve sisterhood and brotherhood with Christ and therefore with God and so on. He didn't have in mind a technological angle about this. But when you get to Hegel, here's what Hegel says, and this is so decisive, and it really informs the whole of modernity in a way, at least as it coming out of Europe. Hegel was a student of Lutheran theology at Tübingen. That's where he started his collegiate training. And he was a close student of Luther, obviously. And here's a spin he puts on Luther. Look, on Luther's theology, look, when God dies on the cross, when Jesus Christ dies on the cross, what does that mean? It means that the transcendent God is over. There isn't any more transcendent God. God has completely emptied himself into the personhood of Jesus Christ. And that means now we human beings are God in the process of completing his transition to total self-consciousness. That's what human history is about. And that you can see that Marx picking up on this, that for Marx, human beings are God in the making, basically. And this really is a core feature of modernity. It's spelled out more clearly in this German philosophical tradition.
Right. And then today we have that with Zizek. He'll make that point, you know, pretty regularly when he waxes religious.
He focuses
on that point of Christ on the cross and the death of transcendence, and that we're in it. And it's quite a striking view, because there's regardless of one's orientation or commitment to Christianity, if you adopt this, you know, and it's we can move inside the viewpoint of there's this transcendent God who's controlling history out of history, and we're just moving along here. And then there's this switch, there's this break in the system, and suddenly all it is this. And there's a vertigo to that, this kind of forward vertigo that's both exhilarating and sort of terrifying, that I think really allows us into a much deeper sense about some of the forces that are driving modernity, and even some of the kind of anxieties and utopias that still, or not even necessarily utopias, but just sort of, you know, the visionary possibilities that we are doing this, it can come through us, we can make the future, we can make history, and at the same time a kind of terrible burden and anxiety because there's no safety net, you know.
Well, there's no big grown up in the sky.
Yeah.
If Hegel and that's right, and Zizek, you know, in his own tantalizing and maddening way, brilliant writer. Talks about, but you know, think about then, what is Nietzsche then? You know, this whole idea of the Obermann. Well, he is part of this. He was the son of a Lutheran minister. He drank deeply from Luther's growing up, and it shapes in some way his vision that what humanity must become something higher, not by going to heaven or not by God intervening, but by becoming what we're capable of being. That deep possibility, I think, is resonant within his thinking, and he's very insistent upon it, although it's very complicated. If he doesn't really spell out what the Obermann would look like except indirectly. But think about the significance of Nietzsche. You know, I last year I was on sabbatical, which I spent in New Orleans eating as many fried oysters as I could find. We spent more than 30 years there at Tulane before moving to Colorado, my wife and I. So I was reading, it's a deep background reading, and discovering the extent to which Nietzsche influenced not only German National Socialism, but also Soviet Marxism. He was a huge presence in the late 19th and early 20th century in Russia, something that I wasn't really very familiar with. And you have the struggle in Europe in the mid 20th century between National Socialism and Soviet Marxism was a duel between competing versions of Nietzsche, arguably.
That's wonderful.
Just as the Soviets tried to create the Nazis tried to create the Obermann, you know, the blonde Aryan type and so on. Well, the Soviets were also trying to create what they call the new Soviet man and woman, each of which had its own valence coming out of Nietzsche. They were both similar and different. Now, if you ever compare the propaganda posters from the 30s and 40s of the Soviets and the Nazis, you'll see they're very similar. There was a lot of similarity. Now, once the genocide of the Nazis was discovered, the extent of it, of course, and also then the Soviet gulag and the excesses of Stalin and so on, then this whole project of creating the Superman and so on really, you know, went away. It just became an embarrassment. It became politically impalatable, unpalatable. But what we're seeing now in the late 20th, early 21st century is a reprise of this, only not under any government supervision. There's no one in charge of this. I do want your listeners to think about this. When I spent almost 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, Google appointed Ray Kurzweil its head of engineering at Google, its head chief engineer, and Kurzweil's goal, according to him, for his whole life has been to create artificial intelligence. And the reason he decided to take a job with Google, and he, as he points out, his first job, because he's always been an inventor and made money on his own, was because they had the computing power to do what he wants.
Yeah.
We have individuals and corporations acting without our permission, without really consulting us, spending their profits on extraordinary goals, the consequences of which are quite unpredictable, but are in line with this idea of humans becoming godlike.
So here's the way that I want to bring in another discourse that also I know that you have spent a lot of time with, is this the kind of transhumanism or evolved humanity that we find in transpersonal psychology, in people who are through meditation, through psychedelics sometimes, through psychological work, developmental work, are also working under the assumption, the idea that we can make ourselves different, better, clearer, more integrated, more powerful. And this, of course, is a wide range that goes from people who are interested in spiritual insight and sort of, you know, becoming saintly or enlightened, to much more commercial, sort of forceful forms of positive thinking and just, you know, working well in the marketplace and you know, sort of transforming yourself into the ideal, efficient vector of capitalism. So it's a very complex set of impulses, but it's or ideas, but it's still basically driven by the idea that through psychological techniques, through meditative techniques, through programs, through listening to self-help videos, whatever, we can sort of make ourselves better. And there's something about this very American story in some ways. It's also a very ancient story. And Ken Wilber has been, you know, a very important figure in developing an intellectually robust way of integrating different models of development into a vision that also puts forward a kind of post-humanity or a more than human, a kind of leaving behind the sort of neurotic body or the broken ego endlessly trying to satisfy itself or work through its traumatic delusions. How are these things playing off against each other? Are we looking at a place where the technological transhuman and the psychological transhuman are becoming one and the same? Are these competing models? Do they inform one another? That's my big question for you.
Well, that's a really good question, and one I've been thinking a lot about. You know, when you look to our artists, I'm talking chiefly about people in who write science fiction or who create science fiction films, their vision of the future is primarily dystopic. There's very few films, science fiction films or literature out these days where the future looks great. There's grave concern about the extent to which human beings will screw this up like we screw a lot of other things up. And given the scale of the possible consequences, which including the possible elimination of our species as a result of something we create, then this should give us pause. Because I think we look to our artists as people who have some kind of intuitions that are valuable about the future, that intuitions that are not necessarily shared by people involved in the technical communities, although certainly there is some overlap there. I mean, as an example of this, a guy named Robert Gracia wrote a wonderful book on a few years ago on apocalyptic AI. And one way he did his research was to go up to Carnegie Mellon Robotics Lab up in Pittsburgh and spent the summer and working with people there. And what he discovered was that a lot of the people in robotics, difficult fields, they have real smart people involved in it, had gotten there because of reading science fiction. In other words, that turned them on, so they decided, well, I want to create some of these critters. But of course, at the same time, science fiction is informed by developments and extrapolations of possible developments in science. So you have a rich interchange going on there. I think one that's enhanced now more than ever. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of interchange between various kinds of artistic creators and scientists. A very interesting moment. But as to the issue of the different forms of yearning for transcendence, I think that's what we're talking about. There's a lot of quackery out there, I suppose, in the self-help world, but there's also some substantial things that I think have been very important. I've benefited from some of these trainings and so on. I think people are in many cases unsatisfied with where they're at, and they want to find a bigger sense of self, a bigger sense of possibility, a deeper way to connect, to make a difference, and so on. I think these are certainly legitimate and praiseworthy yearnings. Historically, they've been expressed in terms of religious traditions. Most religious traditions speak about what we could be if only we weren't burdened by sin of one kind or another. They speak of the possibility of what we will be in the afterlife. In the 20th and 21st century, people want this to happen in this life. It's what there's a wonderful phrase developed by Erich Vogelin, a famous political philosopher in the 20th century. He spoke about the term he used was the immanentization of the eschaton. Now, that's a mouthful, but the eschaton is the ultimate goal of history. And to say that you're immanentizing it, it means that, as in the case of Hegel and Marx and others, you no longer agree that there's a transcendent domain. That domain is now empty, according to these people. And the only possibility of achieving the ultimate goal of history is imminent to history. It's within history, through our efforts, through our willingness to take risks and to dare great things. That's where the ultimate possibility of our history, perhaps cosmic history, is going to be realized. It's not going to be realized by a transcendent God out there watching what's going on. From the modernist point of view, that's not credible. I'm not saying that that's correct. Because even Nietzsche said, when he says, you know, God is dead, he wasn't talking about the transcendent deity. If there is one, that would have nothing to, would not be affected by Nietzsche's pronouncement. What Nietzsche was talking about was a belief in such an entity, which has guided history for so long. He says that belief is no longer credible. But I think the term I would throw out there is the yearning for transcendence.
Great. That's a great place to end for the moment. I have questions bursting in my brain. We got to take a break here. You're listening to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking with Professor Michael Zimmerman. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou. We're here talking with Eric Davis and Michael Zimmerman, and we're talking about the people we will be after we're no longer these people. So to keep in that theme of that quest for transcendence of whatever this condition is, namely everyone brings it back to suffering, it seems like, right? If you go through all the things of people wanting to transcend, usually has to do because they're not happy with something. Like, right, like you said, they want something better. They want to, you know, they're not really, we're all just a bunch of complainers that suffer, and we want to be superheroes that can do whatever we want all the time. So how would you kind of put this overman as compared to that concept of the last man? Or if we're thinking about, like, separating these two, even in the post-humanist stuff of the technology version, like, there's this idea that in order that we can transcend into something that's like, you know, even though, like you said, God is dead, there is some other thing, like, even but above the overman, the dead, there's this other thing too, right? Do you think, how would you compare that with the concept of, like, the last man idea?
Well, you just mentioned a lot of really interesting things. First of all, what Nietzsche meant by the last man was a late 19th century bourgeoisie seeking creature comforts, material well-being, not wanting to be particularly challenged, not liking pain or suffering. This is the heyday of utilitarianism, where the evil is what causes pain and the good is what creates pleasure and so on. So the last man is the human being more or less taking himself or herself out of the developmental game, saying this is as high as we're going to get. There's nothing higher available to us. And Nietzsche rejects this and says, look, human beings are capable of far more than this. What he's saying there is certainly applicable to us in the early 21st century. I mean, there's, our abilities, our capacity for developing new ways to amuse and ourselves and to create pleasure for ourselves, really extraordinary. But yet, despite all that, people are still generally unhappy. You know, I'll be turning 68 this summer. And, if I, in my 20s or 30s, I would have expected by the time I was 68 that I would have my act together and that I would be suffering a lot less. And there's a lot of truth to that. It's better than it was. But I still make mistakes. You know, I realize that using Christian parlance, you know, I'm a sinner, basically. I can't get it right. I do things, say things that I wish I didn't say. If I were a Buddhist, I would say I'm still in the grip of greed, hate, and delusion in various ways. And this is really interesting to me, that condition, it's really, I think, the human condition. And it's why I think in many religious traditions, saints are such interesting people, because they're typically, you know, in one sense, sinners. You can look at Milarepa in the Buddhist tradition and others, as well as in Christian saints. I mean, these are people who have had a really hard time getting their act together, and yet they finally broke through. They had some kind of way forward, but it wasn't a real pretty life, typically, in many cases anyway.
Usually through suffering, yeah.
Yeah, there's all this suffering. I mean, that's the life involves suffering, Buddha says. Now, how do you get out of that? Well, you know, one of the issues I have with AI and those who are in charge of it, I mean, people are typically engineers and scientists and so on, and they have grave concerns about the human body. They want to replace the human body with something far more resilient, capable of, if not immortality, at least of great length of life, and then you'll be able to download into the new model and so on. Well, you know, from a traditional perspective, you know, you can say, well, look, Buddha, one of his famous sayings in Mahayana Buddhism, this body is the very body of the Buddha. The enlightened being does not need a artificial body. This has everything that's required. I think also of feminist criticisms of AI and robotics and so on, the resistance to what looks like a kind of contempt for the body, putting down its organic dimension, the messiness that goes with a human body and so on, as well as the emotions that go with it, the feelings.
The animal part of us, yeah. The ape
animal
man.
Part, you know, and also the human animal, where suffering of various kinds comes from incredibly small slights. You know, the smallest little thing someone might say can really wound us and so on. What would it be like not to be like that? What would it be like just to be a super intelligent and highly conscious, but with none of those emotional pangs, or as well, for that matter, none of the joy, the ecstasy that goes with and sometimes being human.
I wanted to just ask you this too, since you study Buddhism. I don't know if you study a lot of the Taoist material, but in the old Taoist texts, like, you know, there's a lot of Taoists that claimed to achieve those states of immortality. And the way they recommend, like you said, is you don't have emotions. You go into balance. You get, like, cool. You know, you get rid of all these bothersome things like emotional disruption and possession and all that kind of stuff. And one of the main ways the Taoist alchemists do is they eat metal. So it's interesting, like you just said, that transhumanists think the way to get out of this is somehow involved with machines, and that here we have this possible contingency of people that do it. And how do they do it? They're eating these weird metals and doing that.
Well, I have never heard that. I would send you some information about that, and I'll see if I can order some from my organic food store here.
Well, you know, there's another interesting thing that's happening. Just this morning, I was talking to a friend about consciousness hacking, which is sort of a new meme that's coming forward that in some ways is resurrecting ideas and technologies that were very strong in the late 60s and particularly the 1970s in psychology, where it wasn't simply the idea that we could use technology to measure, say, the brain states of meditators or people who are moving into altered states of consciousness or are moving towards or away from undesirable states of hatred or delusion, but who are actually interested in using technology to enhance this. And it's interesting because I think some of the people who are doing it are very, very much overlaid with these more hardcore engineering, robotic, singularity, I would say more masculinist kind of culture. But this is a slightly different quality because it's about using technology not so much to amplify as to feedback. And in a way, it speaks to this idea that we already have, you know, this body is the Buddha body. We already have the capacity for these states within us, and that what technology can do can help sort of reflect it or remind us or direct our own capacity to do it. And so it's a very, what happened to me when I watched it, just on an emotional level, and then this is sort of my question to both of you, is on the one hand, and they had a quote from the Dalai Lama that was like, if there was a chip that I could paint, you know, put inside me without causing harm or without reducing my critical faculties or intellectual capacities, that would, you know, produce, that would allow me to overcome these terrible habits or whatever, I would do it. And it was this weird moment of like, half of me is like, that's so beautiful. It's just in time. You know, we have, it's not a program. It's like, it's helping you bring out this capacities within. And then right next door to that, I have this sort of creepy, you know, dystopian sci-fi mind control, dumbed down Brave New World thing going. And I'm so split about these things. And I bring this up just because I can tell in your work, Michael, that you have a lot of heart for a lot of different aspirations, some of which are very contradictory, and you sort of sense the way that people are striving to come to a better place through whatever way that they're thinking, even if you think there's some serious problems with it. And so I'm really curious how you have come to see this impulse through technology to get to a better place, get to a higher state of being or a more enlightened kind of society. Are you, after all these years, fundamentally more distrustful? Are you cautiously optimistic? Is there where do you find yourself sort of responding to this ongoing mutation?
Well, that's such a good question. I, you know, from day to day, have kind of different feelings about the whole thing. It is so complicated. I love what the Dalai Lama said, because it was he who said it and put it out there. He also said 15, 20 years ago that if something made out of silicon, like a computer, could exhibit consciousness, I mean, that would be okay with him. I mean, he doesn't have any attachment to the organic body as such. What's important to him is consciousness, sentience, and whatever substrate on which that can be embodied is okay with him. So in a way, I was surprised about this, this chip idea. I have thought about this, you know, in connection, you know, we're getting very good, as Ray Kurzweil points out, there's this exponential growth in our ability to gain ever greater resolution of our brain states. And I believe there's that consciousness and brain states are correlated. I don't think you can reduce one to the other. I think they're fundamentally related, but somehow different at the same time. But as we get better at this, what if we were actually able to discover certain fairly common, almost universal things that go on in the brain, which are correlated with a lot of suffering? All right, now.
Well, they did. They're right now. They just funded, I think, like a ridiculous amount of money, the United States government, to develop chips to put in the brains of veterans to reduce PTSD. So they're currently doing what you were just saying. It's the idea is to get rid of the suffering part, which they think that they found, and now they're actually, Eric, making those chips that you were talking about, and the whole auspice surrounding it is to decrease the suffering of the veterans with PTSD.
Yeah, that I think that's a very interesting development. Obviously, it's full of risk. On the other hand, veterans are full of suffering. You know, that reminds me, by the way, I heard on NPR a few years ago, a woman had organized this practice for veterans, especially those suffering in the way you described, and she would have community events in which veterans were introduced, and there was a ritual involved, and the ritual was that those in the community who were present would take upon themselves the sins committed by the soldiers on the behalf of the community.
Wow.
And that traditionally, apparently, this was one way in which the soldiers coming home from war were helped to be healed.
Wow.
The idea was that you did terrible things for us, and we are equally guilty of the bloodshed.
Oh.
Not your thing.
That's amazing.
That's powerful.
Think about it. These guys and gals put themselves out there at terrible risk. And, you know, warfare is horrible. There's just no way around it. Bad things happen. And I can see why these people have nightmares and so on. I'm sure I can easily see myself in the same boat. But this is an example, it seems to me, that what I'm talking about now, of how healing can take place without necessarily the chip. I mean, it's almost like the chip is what we are relying on, because our understanding of human psychology and our lack of community put together lead to the consequences for these vets that are so terrible. On the other hand, since building community is much harder than building chips, it may be that this is going to be the way to go for a while. But I'm quite interested in that, the possibility of, because look, to go back to what I said a while back about meditation as a technique, you know, these technical practices that people have been involved with for thousands of years. These practices change the nature of the brain. They alter the neocortex. They alter the way in which the brain operates. Now, these techniques are techniques of intention, of focus, of awareness practice, of sensory deprivation. There's all kinds of things that go on here. But they're every bit as much of a technique as a computer chip. It's just made of something different. I would hold out that I would not draw a sharp dividing line between these two. Maybe this goes back to your idea of these Taoist masters consuming various kind of metals. But the issue for me is how to change the mind brain in ways that allow for less suffering and allow for more self-expression, greater creativity, a greater ability to connect emotionally and empathically with others. We're not doing very well with that. Our social institutions are not up to it. The loss of religious belief in the part of many people hasn't really been fundamentally replaced by something that can carry the ball. What are we going to do? I don't have an answer to that. And at the same time, I share with everyone who's worried about the chips, I share their worry. On the other hand, there was a lot of worry about a tremendous number of our technological developments that have happened over the centuries, and we can't imagine living without them now. So maybe this is part of the cyborg process.
Yeah. Well, that's again why I come back to this difference between a consciousness technology that is sort of top down, or, you know, reprogramming you or blocking some function from consciousness technologies which encourage feedback, in which are they're creating platforms where you're able to get feedback about how you are processing and to learn to change your wiring in relationship to this feedback that you're getting, because we have capacity for tremendous control of things that we're not aware of until we get feedback about them. I mean, that's what, I mean, just the studies of biofeedback in the 70s show, you know, you have, and yogis do this, you have a capacity to control, like all of us have capacities to control sphincters we don't even know exist unless we're learn to understand where they are in our body, and you can do that even traditionally, but technology can really help doing that, and that seems like a way in which we are involved with our own cyborging, whereas what gets creepy, of course, is the sense that there's no real autonomy in the process. I know we only have a few, 7 minutes left or something, and it's a whole other topic, but I just feel because of your work, it's important to at least throw out a question about the environment, about nature. And the one I'm thinking of now is, you were talking earlier about that in human history, there has been this idea of the transcendent God, that there's something that we need to humble ourselves before, that has a larger claim on things, and that the shift of modernity is like, nope, it's just us, it's only imminent, it's only going to happen through our own processes. And this, of course, becomes very complicated when you think about the environment and how disastrous modernity has been in relationship to this larger matrix that we're dependent on. Some people will say, yes, we need to think of the environment, think of nature as a kind of God, that we have to humble ourselves. We have to be aware that we're limited. We have to, question our own desires in relationship of this larger framework. And you see that kind of religious spirit in environmentalism very deeply, very deeply. And there's another school that's like, nope, we're still just in history, folks. We have to take responsibility for it. There's this a religious idea that we need to humble ourselves before some larger natural force is actually just getting in the way of us managing the problem that we have. And that's maybe a simplistic division, but I think it's a significant one, and people have to find their way around that. How do you feel about that? How do you work your way through that
that's
conundrum?
A great question, and something I've been working with this essay I'm writing now. And because I was heavily involved in deep ecology for many years, and they kind of moved beyond it because it not only did have a kind of anti-anthropocentrism, but sometimes actual hatred of the human in a way, because we're these messy, selfish, smart beings who are constantly causing problems to nature. Let's talk about this for a minute. First of all, there's something incredibly bizarre about human beings. We are really weird compared to other animals. There's just no way around it. We are a sick animal. This is what Nietzsche was talking about. He said, look, consciousness brings with it this kind of pathology. If you have a pet, have you ever seen your dog throw itself up against the wall walking down the hallway and say, holy moly, what am I doing with my life? I can't go on like this. They don't do that. The dogs and cats and animals, they're wonderful. And it's not that they're lesser. They're really different than us in many ways. But there's something that human beings bring on the scene. And many, many of the most ancient stories, creation stories and myths and so on, admit this, that something is strange about the human being. And so, my current thought about that is, look, this planet did fine for billions of years without that. And then 99% of the species that ever existed are dead. They're extinct, all right? So this planet's had a long run without us messing around in it. And in a way, it's our turn. That's what's happening. There may be people who don't like that, but we are the animal in charge of the planet right now. And here's the question we have to pose to ourselves. What kind of planet do we want? Do we want a planet just nothing but, highways, paved everything, and where there's no forest left and there's no wild species and everything's totally managed? Well, most people would say that I don't really want that. What most people want is material well-being and, technological advance and opportunity for making a difference. I mean, they want to human playground where they can feel significant and where they themselves and their families are taken care of well and materially and possibly spiritually as well. That's what's happening right now. I don't see any way around it. We're not going to curb it. We're not going to have some kind of deep ecology curbing of this human desire to invent, create, to be powerful. That's what we're like. The most we can do, I think, is to do our best to remind ourselves of the consequences of what we're up to. That's one reason the environmental movement has been so important, because it pointed out, look, if you keep doing that kind of thing, there are really going to be bad consequences. And the way the world is run now, especially in the developed countries, is so much better environmentally than it was when I was growing up in the 60s. There's been huge positive improvements made possible by environmentalists holding industrial modernist feet to the fire, basically saying, like, you can't keep doing that. So you need that, the environmentalists there, as a reminder of there are limits to what we can get away with right now. And we have to proceed with an awareness that we're biological beings, at least for a time, and we're dependent on the biosphere, which we need to take care of and respect.
Well, you know what, Michael, that sound that we hear in the background is not the the end of humanity, but the end of the show. So I just wanted to thank you so much for coming on Expanding Mind and talking to us about this stuff.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for inviting me.
And you guys can just search his essays online. You just put in Michael Zimmerman, and there's some really good ones on integrallife.com. So check out Michael's work. From me and Majid Ali out there, keep your minds open.